I'm author and critic David Agronoff. I'm a horror and science fiction author, critic, and researcher. In this podcast, I wanted to provide in-depth interviews and panel discussions with everyone from New York Times bestselling authors to researchers, musicians, and anyone I find interesting. Welcome to Postcards from a Dying World. Hello and welcome to another special episode of Postcards from a Dying World. We have a returning guest, not just any returning guest, the reigning top reads of this podcast champion. My top read of last year, Mountain in the Sea, was written by this man, Ray Naylor. We'll talk a little bit about that book before we get into things again, because I've had time to sit and marinate with that book, so I have a question or two, but we're mostly going to be talking about his latest release from Tor, The Tusks of Extinction, which may or may not probably will be in my top 10 next year. It's early in the year, so you know, there could be a lot of good shit coming. I don't know, but Ray, welcome back to Postcards from a Dying World. It's great to have you.
Hey, David, really good to be here.
Yeah, and I do want to do one shameless plug. I almost forgot, but if you're listening to this, my editor at Anti-Oedipus Press, David Harlan Wilson, and I will be appearing the day before the solar eclipse in Bloomington, Indiana, for the book release party for my new science fiction novel, People's Park. This is the first book I wrote after getting seriously into PKD research. So, you know, just take that as it will, but it's the day before the solar eclipse. And by the way, if you come to Indiana for the book release party and hang out with the dickheads, the next day when the solar eclipse happens, William Shatner is hosting the events in Bloomington, Indiana. So Captain Kirk himself, which is, I had nothing to do with, so I can't, you know, say anything about that, but it is the home, the Bloomington is the birthplace of future Star Trek Captain Catherine Janeway. So it makes sense. Ray, welcome back. You were my top read of the year last year. I know there's lots of honors in life, but I like to think that's a pretty big one, at least in my world. If I can say that this was the top read of the year, it's a big deal. And last year, it was a close one because M.R. Carey's Infinity Gate was amazing, too. But the reason why I chose Mountain in the Sea as my top read of the year is partially part of the themes that I think you hit on in your work, which is a lot of science fiction explores what makes us human, what is human. And what I think you do is explore what makes us Earthlings. And
yeah, I love that idea. Like, I saw you you post that and I was like, oh, that's such a cool thing to say. That's way better than I could ever put something like that.
Well, and so Mountain in the Sea has been out for a while now. When it had been out a little bit when we talked before, but I'm sure there's been more reaction. How do you feel about the way this book has kind of floated out there in the world? No pun intended.
So I went to my sort of hometown indie bookstore, City Lights in San Francisco, and Mountain in the Sea was a staff pick there, which was great because this was like the independent bookstore where the clerk was always reading some book you'd never heard of and like kind of dismissed you with like contempt as he like checked out your pathetic selection. And so, you know, I had this deep sense of inferiority walking into City Lights. And it's, of course, I mean, it's a famous bookstore run by this beat poet and all that stuff, had their own press. And so it was
there,
a staff pick.
Familiar.
Yeah. So it was a staff pick there. And what he said about the book, I thought was the coolest thing that anyone could say about it, which was, he said, you know what I like about this book the most is you never know who's going to come in asking for it. He's like, I've never seen a book that had such a wide variety of people walk into the store looking for it. And you couldn't come up with sort of a type that would want to read The Mountain and the Sea. So I thought that was a great thing. It felt like, yeah, if my audience is not identifiable, you know, as like one sort of group of people, I guess that means I've done something well in trying to make it a book that, you know, is at least reaching toward being about more of humanity and maybe more than humanity, right?
Right. And it's a book that you can talk about. We had the experience for those who are regular listeners of this podcast when we did our top reads of the year episode, which I always do with my friend, Judge Mark Rothenberg. He had Mountain in the Sea as an honorable mention. And I talked him into putting it on his top 10 in the podcast. And it was funny. I didn't try to change his mind. I just said, okay. But when we got to talking about the book, then he said, you know what? You're right. I'm going to put it up higher. I don't remember where he put it. I think he moved it to like 5 or something. But what was interesting was how much talking about the book changed it for him. And we had this whole conversation about it's one that you sit with, you think about, you know. It's one that people live with. So that's one of the reasons why I asked, because I wondered if you've had people coming to you or, you know, tweeting at you or anything like that, saying like, hey, like I like this book even more when I thought about it, because my love for the book increased the more I thought about it, for sure.
Yeah, that's interesting. I have had a lot of really cool fan mail for sure, where it was like you could really tell that the book had resonated with someone in these neat ways where it was just surprisingly personal for them. Like they really felt like the book spoke to them. And I felt like there were a lot of people who were like, this book was written for me. You know, like
Yes.
I am the target audience of this book, and I never thought someone would write a book that was exactly for me. And I love that.
Yeah.
The fact that it came from so many different people, I think is just more about the way you as a writer try to give people space to come into the book and sort of exist in it. And I think that's what makes them feel like it is for them. And I do take seriously, I mean, I think we talked about this last time probably, but I really do take seriously the idea that the book is a conversation, right? It's supposed to be this kind of dialogue between writer and reader. It's not supposed to be dictating anything. It's really supposed to be meeting someone halfway in this space that the book creates and then thinking about these questions together, right?
Yeah.
Which I think is the power of fiction, because you're not under this obligation to try to answer these big questions. You're just trying to kind of create this space in which you can ask complex questions and kind of be there with them. I think that's come across for people for whom the book was, you know, written. There are people out there for whom this book was not written. There's the I Wanted More Octopus crowd. They're out there too, but that's also fine. I get it, you know.
Yeah, well, and we talked about this last time too, which is that there's people that come at this book because they're interested in the AI thing, which my buddy Mark on the podcast was very curious about, because in his position as a judge in Indianapolis, he is in charge of the technology that the court uses in the whole building. That's like he's on the committee that does that. And so they've done a lot of exploration of like how AI could help their functioning in as, you know, as a courthouse, which, you know, was something I had never considered because, well, I'm not a legal person. But so he was very interested in the AI aspects, whereas I'm the environmentalist who comes at it from, you know, the earthling perspective and like the One Nature thing. So it was curious just between us when we were having that conversation. He was kind of trying to convince me more about the AI stuff, and I was trying to convince him more about the environmental stuff.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I think did we talk about how the discourse kind of changed around the book, that
Yes,
when it came
we
out in
did. Yeah.
October it was a book about octopuses, and by January it was a book about AI? I thought that was
Yeah.
really interesting. And you know, I mean, it's like the book doesn't change, but the conversation changes, and that changes the way, you know, the book is viewed and read by people. I thought what was also interesting about that is that it's kind of shifted back
Yeah.
now. The book has been out for a while, and now I'm seeing more like connection to the octopus narrative than the AI narrative. Maybe like there's just been a lot of maybe people are a little burned out about thinking about AI. I just think it's like hilarious, like how AI is now everywhere and everybody's like, oh, how can I use AI to do this? Like people are like, how can I use AI to turn my car on? And you're like, you can just turn your car
Well, and that's the whole thing with the
on.
judges. I was just like, well, I don't know. Like, but I guess a lot of it for them was like processing paperwork and
Right.
like, you know, doing all that. But one of the things about Mountain in the Sea that I think unites those two factions is that it's in many ways, and this is why we ended up talking about Stanislaw Lem, is that it's about intelligence and it's about, you know, it's very much about like what it means to be alive and to think, and what a lot of what Mountain in the Sea is doing the heavy work at considering the idea of, in my opinion, the reason why it was so powerful for me is because I constantly would like more people to not think of themselves as human beings, but as earthlings. And people who share this earth, so don't be shitty about it. Don't exploit these things. Don't be awful. And one of the huge messages of Mountain in the Sea is that part of the world, like reaching out to say, hey, basically stop killing us, right? And you know, and it's funny because I had a friend say he describe Mountain in the Sea as a highly literate version of the no kill eye from Star Trek. which was funny because when he said that, like I was like, well, that's a little simplistic, but I hear you. And you know, and it's funny too because I just recently read and I'll lift it up here. This book called The Dolphins of Altair by Margaret St. Clair, who was a famous Wiccan priest in the 60s. But it's funny because this is like the super cheesy, pulpy 60s version of this concept and of like, hey, like the ocean's communicating, stop killing us and all that. And it was so funny because in the beginning, I thought, oh, this is going to share a lot with Mountain in the Sea. It really doesn't because it's very pulpy, but it, in the same vein, I think the message of we're all one planet can't be said enough. And if people think it's preaching to the choir, I think what you're saying about City Lights shows that it's, you know, there's a lot of people beyond the choir that are getting this book. So congratulations on that, because I think it's mission
Thank you.
accomplished.
Thank you. I mean, I think that a lot of people are, it's a little bit maybe in the zeitgeist or whatever you would call it right now, that people are thinking a lot more, I think, about their relationships with animals. And you know, one place I always like start when I'm doing like a book club or something talking about the mountain and the sea is I'll be like, okay, I mean, we talk to animals all the time. Like we communicate with animals regularly. Like you, if you have a pet, you know that you communicate with that pet, that you ask your pet questions in some way, it answers you. You know, it expresses its desires. You fulfill those things for it. You know, there's definitely communication going on all over the place. And I think one of the things that is interesting to pay attention to is how many animal communications with human beings are based around fear. Right? Like when
Unfortunately,
you,
yes, yeah.
right? Like when you walk around on the street and you realize that like all of the animals that are even marginally not domestic are all they're practically always, unless they're like a DC squirrel, in which case they're like super brave, they're really afraid of you, right?
Yeah.
And when you watch animals interact with one another, what you find is they're not always that afraid of one another. There's definitely they know who to be afraid of, and they're definitely afraid of people, right? But like birds aren't necessarily afraid of one another unless it's like a predator, you know, prey relationship. Birds and squirrels will be on the same lawn, you know, doing the same thing. You can see that the built the sort of knee-jerk reaction of most animals is to be very afraid of people, and I think that signals that we're historically have just been nemesis, you know, for them for such a long time that they know that the best thing to do is to look out for us and get away from us as fast as they can. It's very sad.
Yeah, well, and some people might be wondering, like, if they did not see our interview about Mountain in the Sea, why I'm not asking you about your background or where you came from and all that stuff. People should go back and listen to that episode. But you have a unique relationship to the global environment because you've done a lot of traveling and you've seen a lot of the ecology of this planet in your travels. So I think also one of the things that I appreciate about your work is that you bring a unique point of view to this. And, you know, the best thing we can hope for any writer is they bring a unique point of view. And then we look at some of the best, like, you know, Ursula Le Guin was important because she had that academic background and came from two anthropologists, right? And grew up with two anthropologists. And you know, Phil was the working class guy, and you know, Isaac Asimov was the science brain or whatever, you know. So, but what I think you bring to this is that unique relationship with you know, kind of a global thinking. And I wonder, I'm sure that's kind of intentional after all your travels that you're trying to think globally and kind of act, you know, locally with your keyboard, right? You know, but I wonder what you feel about that.
I mean, I've spent probably 20 years outside of the US, mostly in Central Asia, Russia, and then I did that tour in Vietnam as well. I say tour because I'm a Foreign Service officer, not tour like during the war, but I was in Vietnam for a couple of years in Saigon. And then most recently in Kosovo. Yeah, I think what you learn from being overseas is maybe less important than what you unlearn from being outside of your own context. And you know, people will say like, well, where did you feel the most foreign or the most out of place? And my answer, you know, is an honest answer. It's I felt the most out of place in California, honestly. I
Yeah.
mean, growing up as a kid, I never felt more out of place than I did like in elementary school or junior high or, you know, high school in California. And I felt like when I moved overseas, I still felt out of place, but at least I had a reason, right? And
Yeah.
being a foreigner. So I am a foreigner and I am weird and different. And it's in a sense kind of a good mask to wear, like, oh, like I'm, you know, I think about things in a strange way because I'm a foreigner, not because I'm just strange, right? Like,
Yeah.
but I think it when I say like unlearn, I mean like when somebody has traveled, right? They quite often come to a place and in a couple of weeks they feel like they have a really good grasp on it. They really learn something. And if they live there for a semester or something, they'll come home and tell people how people are in France, right? Like
Right.
what are the French like? And they become these experts on Frenchness or whatever. I think that once you have lived in a place for a couple of years, the real feeling you come away with is you don't really understand anything about a place because places are just too big. And the variety of people you meet there is just as wide as the, you know, variety that you would meet in your own country. And what you really come to understand is being a human being is just super complex and difficult all over the world. There's no generalizations that you can really make about how people are in X. But what is really clear from all of the places that I've been to, and especially in Central Asia, where the Soviet Union did a lot of environmental damage. Like there's some places there that really look post-apocalyptic. Like if you go up near the Aral Sea or places like that, you really can see how much damage people are capable of doing to a place in a pretty short period of time. Because when you're talking about the Soviet Union, you know, your maximum span is 70 years, you know, just a little over. And then when you're talking about how, you know, the Aral Sea was destroyed, it was destroyed like in a generation, right?
Yeah.
So you see a lot of that. And you do get a sense of just how fraught our relationship is globally with the environment, and how much danger we're in also, because this is a world where a lot of developing countries are like, well, you got to do a lot of damage to the environment, right? Making yourselves rich. And now it's our turn. And who are you to stop us, right? And as incomes rise in every country, the effect of that increase in income is massive environmental damage. Right? And that's what's happening in China. That's what's happening in India. That's what's happening in any place where there's a rising population growing more wealthy. Because wealth means consumption. And consumption means environmental damage. So you do see that too, for sure.
Which is one of the reasons why we, I think, need to live by example and try to be better environmental stewards in this part of the world. But
yeah,
I think I'm really heartened by the fact that there has been more international science fiction being published.
Me too.
And, you know, you have your Nnedi Okorafors who writes African, and I just had Lavi Tidar on, the Israeli. Huh. Yeah. And Lavi was hilarious because he was talking to me about how he's never written America into a science fiction novel. He's never mentioned America in a science fiction novel.
Uh-huh.
And how he was saying, like, he's going to one day, but it's not going to be any recognizable America, which I thought was funny. And, you know, and I thought about, you know, because we were talking beforehand, of course, about, you know, I always talk about Philip K. Dick. And I think one of the things that was always cool about him, too, is that he never worried if stuff kind of had realism as far as, like, you know, oh, what, we're not going to be on Mars by 1994? I don't care. You know, right. I'm writing this story. And I'm not saying everybody needs to do that, but I thought it was cool that he did. And one of the things that I really, your book is very grounded. It feels like it could happen. However, I think there's plenty of weirdness in Mountain in the Sea for people who want their science fiction weird. Yeah. Partially because I think you extrapolate a lot of things from nature that I think are hard science fictional, but also, you know, stretch the imagination. So if people are worried about that, no, it's very good in that way too. But we are here to talk about the other book, Tusks of Extinction. And we're going to do a little bit before we get into spoilers. And then I'm going to pick your brain because I just read this last week. And I think it's really, really, really great. I think you set a very high bar with Mountain in the Sea. So it's almost, you know, it's a tough position for you to, like, put another book out because, man, that one was so good. But for me, Tusks of Extinction did the trick. It made me go, all right, Ray Naylor, I'm on to you. I like it. I want more. And so Tusks of Extinction, what, in a non-spoiler way, how old is this book? Was it written after Mountain in the Sea? Was it written before Mountain in the Sea? What's the backstory there?
It was written after the Mountain in the Sea. It was written before the Mountain in the Sea was published. Mm-hmm. So it was written in the period I had just finished Mountain in the Sea. I had gotten my agent. I had sold the Mountain in the Sea. And then I think I started writing Tusks about 6 months after that. So I think it was mostly written in like 2021.
Mm-hmm. Now there's a whole novel in here. There could have been a whole novel in here. Why did you choose for the novella length? Because it easily.
Yeah, I get that. I think I love the novella length. I think it gives you this ability to do something that that a novel like it that the novella length for me kind of combines some of the magic of a short story with some of the magic of a novel. And I mean, personally, if novellas were the most commercially successful, format, I would just write them. Like, I honestly think it's like a perfect length for me. With The Mountain and the Sea, it was the first thing I had written that was that long, and it was hard for me because I'm really like a compressive writer, I try to compress as much material as I can into a small space. And when I go back to edit, one of my routine edits is to cut 10% out of anything that I've written, to just by word, number, get rid of at least 10%, sharpen everything up, make sure that I'm being as clear as possible. So for me, it's just a perfect length to tell a story in. And for science fiction, I feel like it's a great length. And then I think that a lot of the classic science fiction novels were like these like really short novels without a lot of extraneous, material quite often in them. Like I like to think
I'm a big
about.
fan of the 55,000, word range. And, it's funny because, one of the things that's great in horror is that Stephen King popularized the four novella collections. So it's really easy in horror circles to be like, oh, I'm going to do my four novella collection because, and we just saw recently, like Josh Malerman just did one, Stephen King's son, Joe Hill, did the Strange Weather. And so they've kind of, horror has normalized the four novella collection. And I wish science fiction would do a little bit more of that because I think, they're little, each one is a little bit longer than a short story. It can do a lot of the things that a novel can do, but doesn't overstay its welcome. And I'm not saying that I wasn't happy with what I got. I'm just saying I liked the story enough. I could have done more.
And I think that's where I wanted to leave people. I mean, I wanted people to think, yeah, I could have spent a lot more time in this world and been really happy with it. I wanted to leave them wanting more a bit. I also wanted to write a sharp and kind of action-driven book that was also had enough of the philosophical elements that I wanted to be in there to make it meaningful to me.
And it's
And
hard for me to talk about because I went into this cold. I went into this on the strength of Mountain in the Sea. I didn't read a thing. And so I had a really great experience not knowing a damn thing about the plot. So that's why I'm a little cagey about saying anything. But I will to say this before we do any spoilers, if you've listened this far and I haven't given the spoiler warning, so you're okay at this point. But what I would say to people to sell them on, you got to go out and read this right now, is for one thing, there's as many ideas in this as a novel twice its length. It has lots of ideas, character, story, all that. But that question that you made me ponder in Mountain in the Sea, the what does it mean to be an Earthling, is even more apparent in this book because I think it's not that it isn't there in Mountain in the Sea. It's definitely there, but the particular relationship of the main character makes it impossible not to consider that question. Whereas in Mountain in the Sea, I could see people reading it and maybe not pondering that if they weren't an astute reader. But I think it's impossible to ignore it in Tusks of Extinction. And for that reason, I actually like that it's a little bit more direct. And I did have one friend that he was like, oh yeah, it was great. But Mountain in the Sea just wrecked him. So he was like, he said, oh, my bar was so high that, and then I told him, I was like, well, one of the things I said to him was, because he was surprised when I said that in some ways, you know, even though Mountain of the Sea was my top read of the year, Tusk worked for me almost better because for me, it was so direct and I liked how direct it was. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, I wanted it to be as emotionally sort of fraught and, you know, have as much impact as I could pack in those 30,000 words. It also wrote really easily. What was interesting about this one is it's the easiest thing I've ever written by far. I sold it on a synopsis and, which is a rare thing. And then I wrote it from the synopsis thinking this is not going to be that much like the synopsis that I sold it on because my stuff is always going to be driven by character. And it was very character driven in the sense that I sat there in the morning writing Tusks as if I was just watching it happen.
Yeah.
In front of me. I came really prepared. I had done all my research. I didn't have to stop and go look for anything because I had it all in my head. And I literally, it was like, I sat there and I just watched the movie and wrote it and took dictation. It was that easy. I've never had anything that was like that before, but that also told me that like that was a story that really had that kind of purity, you know, and directness that I was looking for. There were no tricks. It was very, you know, I knew exactly when I wanted to break chapters. A very interesting experience. Really, the Mountain in the Sea was different. The Mountain in the Sea was like full of surprises. There were times when I would get, you know, frustrated and have to go back and sort of figure out where I was trying to go. It had all kinds of pathways I could have followed, but, you know, didn't. It was like working my way through this, like, cavern, you know, under the sea, maybe, right? Like this just maze.
You know, and that's probably why it spoke to me, because I'm a structure guy. I love when I can feel a novel just flow with the structure. Like that's one of my favorite feelings. And so a lot of times when I read, because I'm an outliner, and I know you're not necessarily an outliner, but I love when I feel like I'm in safe hands with a story where the writer knows where it's going. For me, I like that feeling. You know, and so that's something too, because Tusk of Extinction, another thing about this book is that, before we get into spoilers, is that in a lot of ways this is something that only science fiction could do. This message, this point, and you know, somewhat of Mountain in the Sea you could do with the AI stuff, you know, without getting science fictional, but this is pure philosophical science fiction in a very propulsive story. So that's one of the reasons why I love it. But anything you want to say about that before we get into spoilers? Let's spoil everything. All right. So people, if we have not sold you on Tusks of Extinction to this point, you are insane. I'm telling you, if you don't get it, go to your library. If they don't have it, make them order it. You know, use my review if you need to. Just get this book, get it out there, get it to people. Tusks of Extinction is great. But now we're going to do the spoiler warning. We're doing the spoilers. So, you know, one quote that, and I don't know if I quoted this in my review, but I know I quoted this the first time I posted a picture that I was reading the book. But you had a point in the book where a character says, no one's ever going to want to bring us back from extinction. and, you know, that's a funny thing to think about. And I want to put a pin in that. We'll come back to that. But let's talk about this. Now we're talking about the story. So when did you come up with the concept of, you know, this elephant expert who was murdered trying to save elephants, like leading a herd of woolly mammoths? That is a really cool concept. This is one you've got to know. You're going to be asked, where did this come from? You know, Was there a fuse moment for this idea, or is it something that you kind of sat on for a while?
And I wish I had better answers for these questions, because I wish it had been like some single aha moment, but I think it was just like these different threads that I was thinking through. I had all this material from having worked fighting the ivory trade and rhino horn trafficking when I was in Vietnam, because Vietnam's a major throughput country and like destination for both elephant ivory and rhino horn. And I had worked on those issues when I was yes, the environment science technology and health officer there with the Foreign Service. That was also when I was on Con Dao for the Mountain and the Sea. So that's also how these two books are kind of linked, is they both draw from the Vietnam experience. But I knew I was going to do something with that. And then I was interested in so I went from there to seeing a National Geographic article about these guys up in the tundra and then out in Siberia on riverbanks, basically digging up old mammoth ivory and selling it. And then I read an article somewhere about how the trade in mammoth ivory, which was legal, unlike the elephant ivory trade, was actually increasing the poaching of elephants because elephant ivory could now be disguised as mammoth ivory.
That
And
is
I was like,
diabolically evil.
yeah, like, yes, diabolically evil, right? And so there was this kind of nexus, and that made me think of this other thing that I had seen when working on the elephant ivory trade, which was so elephant ivory had become so valuable, the price went way up in ivory. And that was back in the early 20 teens, the price went way up in ivory. It became so valuable that you could pay for one of these legal big game hunts, and you could go out and shoot an elephant. And if you could, and now normally you would re be returning to a country where that ivory would be pretty strictly controlled, but if you weren't, you could sell the ivory for much more than you had to pay to go on the game hunt. So it actually became profitable to send people on these things and just get them to legally poach ivory for you. And so what they were doing in Vietnam was sending sex workers to Africa on game hunts to kill elephants and then bring the ivory back with them. So you had human traffic, like victims of human trafficking being like used to kill animals in order to traffic in their teeth, right? And
Oh
bring
my
them
God.
to Vietnam. And it was like, there's this, I just saw this huge web, of exploitation and how it spread across the globe. And I thought, well, I have to write about this at some point. And then I came upon some interesting book on de-extinction of the mammoth. And I was like, oh, that's it. Like, that's the thing. I can write this book about de-extinction of the mammoth and put all of this other stuff in there if I, can come up, if I just have this idea that you have someone who was working on the ivory trafficking with the elephant who's murdered, but not before their mind is uploaded and say and stored, and then they have to come back and lead this mammoth group as a mammoth. And the place that idea came from was I've been reading a lot about evolution for the Mountain and the Sea, and one of the factors in evolution that's forgotten quite often is culture, right? That
Right.
culture actually forms a part of evolution, and that there are many species for whom, not just humans, but many, many species for whom culture is much more important than instinct or even their physical form in many ways.
Yeah, and we'll talk about elephant mammoth culture in a little bit because I think that's really important. And it's one of the things that makes this book incredible. But what I think is cool is there you've got a whole web of ideas that, and that shows, I think, people who, in 100 pages, you were able to drill down a lot of these things and put these tendrils in. And I think one of the other things too is that there'll be layers that if people do like a reread or multiple reads later, or they're looking at it later, that they're going to find these things. And no one should be surprised about it. I mean, the title Tusks of Extinction, you know, you're dealing with that. There's a quote in the book: when you bring back a long extinct species, there's more to success than DNA. And that's what you were talking about with the culture.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, so before we really dive into the culture thing, like one of the ways that I was kind of thinking about this is, you know, Demira, if I'm saying her name right. Yeah. Demira is kind of like a Diane Fossey type character. So it's kind of like, imagine if you could do Gorillas in the Mist where you know, where you could bring her back as a gorilla or whatever, you know. Right. And Demira, having worked so hard to save these elephants, is uniquely positioned to understand the culture. And probably the biggest, so when I started reading this book, you have Demira, she's a POV character. I went into this cold. So she has a tusk. She's roaming around. I'm like, is this an elephant? Oh, is that what we're doing here? We're doing a book from an elephant's point of view. And there's good confusion. I'm going to say that, you know, I was confused, but I kept reading. And I thought it was good confusion, because when I read science fiction, I'm okay. I'm with that philosophy of, I can be confused for a while, just don't bore me. And if you give me ideas, I admit I was confused for a little bit, but that made the reveal of who Demira was to be a jaw dropper for me.
Mm-hmm.
Because for a while I was thinking, oh, okay, well, there's this elephant character, and maybe they have the same name. Maybe she named, you know, I thought for my, you know, once you started kind of going back and forth, I thought, well, maybe they just had the same, you know, she was named after her, and that'll be the reveal.
Right.
And then when the reveal came, I just wanted to say that it worked for me perfectly, because I was like, whoa, okay.
Uh-huh.
Now I see what's going on. So this scene where Dr. Demira, you were murdered, and mm-hmm. she realizes that she's kind of this disembodied consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, she hasn't felt her body. Can you tell me about like how you developed this scene and how you saw this working? Was that in the synopsis, or was that
you're talking about the scene where she wakes up and they're trying to convince her to become a mammoth? Basically, he gives her this choice. So this was
scene worked for me. It really worked for me.
Thank you. So I've been studying a lot about, or thinking a lot about, embodiment of meaning and language and consciousness, like just how much of how we experience the world really has to do with our structures as animals, right? And one of the things that they have, you know, the people have studied a lot about, you know, about, is how extraordinarily distressing it is for people to not be able to identify where their body is, like its position. And there's different sort of aphasias where you lose the ability to sense how you're sitting or where you are, or you lose your sense of connection to a limb, for example.
If you wake up in a float or gravity, that kind of
thing. All kinds of that stuff. And so I really wanted, in this scene, I'm really trying to dig into how distressing it would be not to have a body, and just how strong embodiment really is as a force. Because the argument that the book, one of the sort of arguments that the book is laying out, is that the shape of our body and the senses that we have shape the ways our intelligence, is, and how we experience the world. And Demira is slowly over the book, you know, big spoiler, right? Becoming a mammoth, right?
Yeah.
She kind of starts out as being a person inside a mammoth. But as she goes on and she starts drifting further and further away from her personhood, her human nature, and entering into this different state, which is symbolized in a bunch of different ways in the book. But that's like the beginning of it. So In that scene, I'm just pulling all the physicality out and showing how impossible it is to be a mind without a body, and just how distressing that is.
Now, I don't know if you saw this argument happening online about your book because you did not chime in. However, fellow author Keith Giles and I, who read this book, we argued whether DeMiro was just an AI or was actually, I said that she's kind of an echo of her humanity. And then we ended up having this whole argument of whether, basically, there were three of us who had read the book who were arguing about this, and we all kind of took different positions. There was the position that it's just an AI program and it's learning to be a woolly mammoth, and then it becomes a living being because it's a part of the body. And then there was, no, she is a person because our memories make up who we are. And then we had a little bit of the no. Your memories are a part of who you are. So, do you have an opinion on this? Because we argued this for a little bit about on Facebook. And I'm wondering
Well,
how you feel about it.
I mean, it's sort of all of the above, right? So,
Right.
this is a model, right? Not a person, but a model of a person, a map of a person. You could think of them as like a map that's so detailed that it's not just a map of a city, right? It's a
Right.
map of every argument happening in every single apartment in a city, right? Every person sitting watching TV and what they're thinking about, like a map down to that level of detail. And the question you start to ask yourself then is like, how much is that a map? And then how much is that the thing itself, right? So it's a map, a model of Demira that is perfect as it can be to the moment when all that information was uploaded.
Right.
Is that a person?
And what I think is important is, and then let's get into this thing about elephant culture, because Demira becomes the only way the mammoths can survive, and they're the closest form to elephant that we have left in this world. To me, the most shocking moment of the book, or the part that most like gut punched me and resonated with me. And if I could have a book that makes me feel like a really strong emotion, then yes, I'm gonna love it. And that part was when I believe I quoted it in the review. I said before that you are the only existing human mind that worked and lived with wild elephants, and that is true. But I should have put it another way. You are the only existing mind of any kind that knows the culture of elephants. The last wild elephant died over a half century ago. Our surrogates were raised in captivity as every elephant they know. Wild elephant culture is dead on planet Earth, except in one place, your mind. That is, to me, the mission statement of the book. That is the heart, the soul of the book. It's the part that touched me the most, and it's the part that I kept thinking about after I closed the book. So to me, that makes the difference, because it doesn't matter what Demira is or was. What Demira is now is she is the last thread that is keeping an entire species alive. That makes her so important, and that makes her a bridge between a dead culture and one that could survive to the future. And it's such a powerful scene. So hats off to you, Ray.
Thanks, man.
Man, that was awesome.
Yeah, she's the memory of what it is to be an elephant, right? Like that's which is a strange thing to be when you're a person,
Yeah.
right?
And that's why I said that this could only be in science fiction, right?
That's the power of science fiction, right? It allows you to just do these amazing things that you couldn't do in mundane fiction at all, which is not to say that you can't do a lot of cool stuff with literary fiction, but science fiction just gives you tools that you wouldn't have. I do think that our memories are fundamentally who we are in many ways, that in a way that nothing else is. They're not the entirety of who we are, but they are sort of fundamental to consciousness. And I think memory is one of the things that's maybe the most core for consciousness. Like, I'm not sure consciousness could exist without it, because my theory of consciousness is that the basic way consciousness emerges, probably, if I had to game this out on planet Earth, is it's about trajectory, right? So
Right.
you are an animal and you need to get somewhere. You need to know three things. You need to know where you just were, because that's part important. Think about, like, the placement of your foot, right? You need to know how your foot was just placed, where you are now, and where you're going to place your foot next. And that's how you direct yourself in the world. And I think that's a process that demands some kind of interpretation, right? And the thing that's interpreting that position is eventually the same thing that will become incredibly elaborate conscious minds, calculating positions within societies and in abstract realms and in imaginary spaces and all sorts of other things. But that sense of where you were is so important for us as people, because it's not just a physical sense, it's also a story sense. It's how we tell the story of who we are and who we are going to be and what our potentials are. And that's the other thing that, for me, the Tusks of Extinction is really about, is, the story of who we are and how to preserve that and use it, and how it limits us and how we engage with it, and that kind of angle.
Well, and that's where it brings me back to that quote when the character says, "No one's ever going to want to bring us back." There's never going to be anyone to want to bring us back. And that hit me too, because look, I generally tend to be a bit of a misanthrope. So, but I think what the point is that we're the ones that are kind of taking the wrecking ball to this planet, and there's just no denying it. So, at a certain point, where there are certain people within our species that are great people that are trying to save all these species, but basically, we're kind of, not worthy in that situation. Well, look, there's a great history of animal rights in science fiction. Phil being one of the great examples with Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, which is underrated for the ethical issues that Walter Miller had a really incredible, the guy who wrote Canticle for Leibowitz had a really amazing novella. What was it called? I have to know now because I had to pull it off the shelf. It's called Conditionally Human, which is a really great animal rights story. And I think that Tusk of Extinction, it fits in there as one of those stories. And I think that the whole idea of elephant culture being so central to the theme is one of the things that makes it so great. And And Mountain in the Sea too, I would say that octopus culture is obviously a huge part of it. So, I don't know. I'm sure down the line we'll get more animal cultures in Ray Naylor fiction, but I think it's an amazing thing that you're doing to just bring home to people to think about, I know my wife and I accidentally overheard. We were at some place and some guy was talking about some fancy restaurant where they were like, oh, they serve three different kinds of octopus. And he was talking about it, and my wife and I just looked at each other, and I just kept thinking about how it related to Mountain in the Sea of where it gave me such a different appreciation for thinking about you know, and I've always been, I'm a 30-year vegan. So like, I think about these things, but, you know, I think it's really fantastic for science fiction to do that. And, I just really appreciate that about Tusks of Extinction. Is there anything I'm missing that you really wanted to make a point about, or I didn't say in my review? Because, you know, there's lots of things about Dimera, like accepting her fate and learning how to, you know, remember as an elephant or a mammoth, mm-hmm. how fragrances are different, how she remembers things whole. There's a lot of cool ideas that you got going on in here. What did I miss?
Oh, I don't know. But, you know, I think people would like discover those little things, you know, for themselves. And everyone sort of picks a pathway through the book in the sense that the words are the same every time, but like it's what's accentuated for you, like what you bring into it is like how you're going to walk that path as a reader. I mean, sometimes I hear people talk about a book that they both read and you think they've read two completely different books,
right?
Which is sort of the magic of it. But I would say, you know, maybe this is a good thing to kind of end on is, for me, one of the cool things about science fiction, and you really made me think about this, that I like is the way that you can just turn the dial up on something that's real. And, but just, you know, you just turn the dial up, and turning the dial up allows people to see with more clarity what's right in front of them the whole time. So I would like to tell the story, if I don't know if you know this story or not, of the yam washing monkey. Have you heard this? So this is a story about the reality of animal culture, right? And how culture is a part of evolution. So there were these Japanese scientists. They wanted to study these monkeys that were living on a small island, but it was difficult to get to the monkeys. This is a true story, by the way. Difficult to get to the monkeys in the forest. So they would put a big pile of yams on the beach. And then the monkeys would come out of the forest and they would, you know, collect the yams, eat the yams, and this was a good way to get them out in the open where they could be observed as a group. And the monkeys didn't really like the yams that much because they're covered in sand and, you know, it's not really that tasty. They kind of struggled to eat them. It's like, you know, it's a good source of sugar and carbohydrates and stuff for them, but they were a little annoyed by it. And then one day, one of the monkeys went into the water with a yam and washed it. And that monkey then proceeded to teach the other monkeys how to take the yams down into the water and wash their yams. And now the monkeys became much more enthusiastic about the yams. And so when the Japanese scientists would come and bring the yams, all the monkeys would gather their yams, go down into the water and wash them and then eat them. Probably also good because it like a little bit of salt, right, on the yams too. So lots of ways in which this is great. Well, you know, a couple of decades go by and the yam washing monkey, the original one, she dies. But all the monkeys at this point on this island are yam washing monkeys. And not only that, they're also bringing their children into the water with them. And they're swimming in the water. And the kids are playing in the water. And the monkeys are starting to chase after fish and discover, you know, shellfish in the water and all of these things. And you see that this entire aquatic, sort of semi-aquatic monkey culture has evolved around this one act of washing the yam. And so that's the story. But now if you turn it upside down and you think, okay, now you're the first scientist, right? And you arrive on this island and you see these monkeys in the water, right? Splashing around and playing and also incidentally eating yams, right?
You might not know why they were doing it.
You would probably think that it was their instinct to do this, right? That they had evolved to fill this kind of niche in the world. But in fact, it's entirely cultural. It's all learned behavior. It's even though the original teacher is gone, The whole monkey culture on this island has been fundamentally changed by this single act of this one monkey. And this is just one small instance of how culture is a huge part of evolution. And so, when you look at bird behaviors, like it's really dismissive of us as humans. We have this way of thinking that everything everyone else does on the planet, when I say everyone else, I mean the non-human earthlings, right, that we are sharing this place with, is programmed into them. It's just built into them. It's not thought, it's just instinct, right? But what we do is cultural, right? We have some instincts, but most of what we do is thought and cultural. What we're not recognizing is what makes us fundamentally different from them is symbolic language, which gives us extraordinary powers that they don't have to do things over long periods of time and organize things in some pretty spectacular ways. But what sets us apart from animals is certainly not culture. Because practically all the animals that we would look at on any given day have cultures, and learn behaviors from their parents and that sort of thing. I mean, interestingly enough, the actual octopus species is probably one of the exceptions to this, in the sense that most octopuses live their entire lives alone. And so they don't quite often really have any octopus culture, but they, as individuals, are so curious that they're really masters of their environment anyway. So they're doing something very different. But I just think that's a perfect example. And when people question, whether animals can have culture, that's my go-to story, is the yam washing monkey. Like, this makes it very clear how, if you didn't see the beginning of the story, the way you would never get to, like, oh, this is a conscious act by a single animal taught to its tribe, right? And then passed on through generations, evolving into an elaborate set of behaviors, right?
And we weren't there for the beginning of almost any wild animal species, so how would we know?
Exactly. Exactly.
And that's part of the whole thing. And when we talk about science fiction, and we obviously are both Stanislaw, I know you say Liam, I'm sure you're correct. Yeah. You know, his work was so great because it was so philosophical about the idea of the vast nature of the cosmos, right? And like how it's impo how out of touch we are because we don't understand these grand and huge scales. And science fiction is uniquely positioned for us to consider or think about those things. And that is one of the things that both of your works that I've read have done. What's next, Ray? What's coming next down the pike?
Just finished what is probably the sort of, like the pseudo final draft, because there's, of course, copy edits and all that stuff, and little changes here and there of the next book, which I had already sold. So that will come out maybe sometime in 2025. There's nothing official yet, but that's going to be very different. So I'll warn everyone right now that it's not about animals, although there's always going to be animals in there. This one is going to be much more about politics and human systems. The
I'm
best way I
down.
could put it is, the world building behind the mountain in the sea, behind the action, a lot of the stuff that didn't get addressed, that's going to be kind of at the centerpiece of this book, which is not related to,
Okay.
oh, well, they're
It's
all
not the
related.
same universe then.
Not the same universe, but I like to think of it as, like, although it's not the same universe, you're going to be able to identify a lot of similarities, and you're going to feel very, it's going to feel very familiar, but there's going to be some differences as well. I like my universes to
I'm
feel like
sensing that we have not announced the title yet, or we don't know the title yet. So.
No, I know the title. I know the title,
Okay.
but I haven't announced it yet. So
Yeah.
I'm not going to go there
So,
yet. That does apply.
okay. Well, I then my senses were strong. So, I am sometimes strong in the force, but
Yeah, that's next. And then I've got three ideas right now, fighting to be the next book after that one.
ooh, well, maybe they could work together. I don't know. Well, you know, it's yeah. You never know sometimes what's going to be the one that wins out. And
No, totally, totally.
yeah. And
Go ahead.
personally working on these edits for the nonfiction book right now, I instead of thinking of like ideas for my own stuff, when I do, a lot of times I try to shut myself down. I'd rather like make up fake seasons of Star Trek in my head at night because that's a little less dangerous for distracting me. But on that note, well, I really appreciate it, Ray. This is another great interview. Tusks of Extinction is a fantastic piece of work. Again, it's one that nestles in my brain, and I think that whole thing with the elephant culture in that line is one of the most powerful paragraphs I've read in modern science fiction in a long time. So
Thanks, man. That means a lot. I really appreciate it. It's a pleasure always to talk to you. I hope I'm able to write enough good books that you'll invite me back a few more times and we could do this some more.
yeah, well, we can talk about other things sometimes too. We do panels
Awesome.
here every once in a while, so
Cool.
we are covering the Science Fiction Hall of Fame stories on here. So if I find one that I think you're perfect for, I'll let you know. But it's I think the conversation is the final act of a book like this. So I really appreciate doing that. And on that note, folks, keep in mind, I did see Mountain in the Sea on an end cap at a San Diego Barnes and Nobles for ocean themed books, which I thought
Oh, wow.
cool. I took a picture of it. I meant to post it. And while we're talking about Barnes and Nobles, my novel, The Last Night to Kill Nazis, is available nationwide there at Barnes and Nobles too. So when you go to pick up Tusks of Extinction, consider getting a Last Night to Kill Nazis because a vampire killing Nazis is always fun. And
That's a good
on
time.
that note, folks, with that shameless self-promotion, I'm gonna let Ray go. It's late in Washington, D.C., and I really appreciate your time, Ray. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, dude.